Today we talk to Dr. Divitt about golf injuries.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week we tap the minds of PGA and USGA course pros, architects, authors, and teaching gurus to provide you with tips, drills, insights, and advice so that you can lower your scores. Golf Smarter is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome. Glad you can join us for another Golf Smarter podcast, which is brought to you in part by the Bird Golf Academy. If you're looking for the ultimate golf learning experience this spring, please check into the Bird Golf Academy. And as a Golf Smarter listener, you receive a 10% discount. They don't do that. So go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the link to Bird Golf Academy. When you make your reservation for the Academy, make sure you tell them that you heard about them on the Golf Smarter podcast. As I've explained over the last few episodes, I'm going to be traveling to Florida for the NFL experience that'll be in cooperation with the Super Bowl activities. What that means to you is that I recorded this segment and our conversation with Kenny Nicholson last week. Even though the interviews take place anytime from day to a week before the episode is published, I usually record the intro and the Edwin Watts golf segment the day that the show is published. So, if the world has come to an end, it's not going to be covered in this show. But our guest today is a board-certified orthopedic surgeon and self-described golf nut. Trained at Columbia University and the Hospital for Joint Diseases in New York City, Dr. Larry Foster has been in practice in New York for more than a decade, and he's published a handbook for golf injury prevention and treatment entitled Dr. Divitt's Guide to Golf Injuries. Welcome, Dr. Divitt.
Hey, Fred, how are you? I'm glad to be with you.
I'm glad that you're here. Your book, The Guide to Golf Injuries, I think is an important book, but why don't you explain to us what is a golf injury?
Well, contrary to popular belief, golf is not a cushy gentleman's pastime. And we sort of have a preconception of golf as being something that you do casually on the weekend and you play and you have a couple of drinks and you go home. And people don't really recognize golf as the strenuous sports activity that it really is. Combine that with the fact that it's played by millions and millions of people, many of whom are casual athletes and not in the greatest of shape. And you end up with a game that actually causes a significant number of injuries. So a golf injury is any condition such as a tendonitis or aggravation of low back pain or injury to the shoulder, rotator cuff, whole host of injury types that occur as a result of playing this game, which we tend to do again and again and again with great dedication. And the other thing about golf is that it, because of its strenuous nature, it actually aggravates conditions that may not have actually been caused by golf, but certainly can be tweaked and aggravated by playing the game. And in a population that plays so voraciously, and in a population that's getting older, golf injuries becomes an important topic.
Well, here's a question that's not only bad for me, but bad for our sponsors. Is golf bad for us?
No, I think when you weigh everything, I think golf is a great game, and I think it's a terrific game because it can be played through the generations. You know, with the handicap system, you can have a 12-year-old having fun playing with his dad, who's playing with his dad, who might even be playing with his dad, and you're outside. If you walk the course, you're getting a significant amount of exercise. You got fresh air. You get away from the rigmarole of the daily grind. And I think in general, golf is a terrific game. But having said that, I think if people think of it as a completely benign activity and don't take the reasonable precautions to prevent injury, I think they're going to find out the hard way that it can actually hurt you.
Well, then let's talk about those reasonable precautions.
Well, in my book, I talk about, the injury rate overall for recreational golfers is about 60%, which is surprisingly high for people.
That's outrageously high.
That's right.
60% of golfers live with injuries or get injured? Well,
will sustain a golf-related injury at some time during their playing career, during their playing years.
Wow.
It's even higher for golfers over the age of 50. It's actually about 67%. And these numbers are based on surveys that have been published in the medical literature of thousands of recreational golfers. And what's interesting is that the injury rate for professional golfers is even higher. It's about 80%.
So wait a minute. You're saying not will live with pain, but will sustain an injury at some point during their playing career.
That's correct. Most injuries, okay, you know, admittedly, will get better on their own, and especially if they're treated properly and precautions are taken to prevent a recurrence. So that doesn't mean that 60% of all golfers are going to be playing in pain forever, God forbid. The truth is a lot of pro golfers are playing in pain because that's the way they butter their bread. And so they get out there and play again even before they're fully healed, unlike most recreational golfers might do. But to get back to your question, the root cause of most golf injuries, especially in amateur golfers, boil down to what I call the recipe for injury. And there are four ingredients to the recipe for injury. The first is poor conditioning. The second is overuse. The third is inadequate or improper warm-up. And the fourth is poor swing technique. And I think most, or if not all, of injuries to recreational golfers can be traced back to one or more of those factors. And I think if you talk to golfers out there or the people who are listening to this cast who have been injured are nodding their head right now and can probably relate it back to one of those factors.
Oh, yeah. I want to go over each one of those if we can.
Sure.
So I'm not going to get ahead of myself. Let's start with number one.
Poor conditioning. If you just look around at any golf course, and you'll see that golfers come in all shapes and sizes. And
oh, yes.
Some of the sizes are more round than others. And
well, that's just America in general.
Exactly. It's true. And golf being one of the most popular participation sports, it's played by people who aren't necessarily in the best of shape, myself included. I include myself in all of those categories.
You are a golfer, aren't you?
I am a golfer. Yeah, I'm a lousy golfer. That's why they call me Dr. Divot. But but I am a golfer. I love it, and I'm getting a little bit better. But
well, welcome to the team.
Yeah, and the. There have been studies that show that committing just a little bit of time to basic flexibility and strengthening exercises for any athlete, but for golfers in particular, can really pay off in dividends in terms of avoiding injury. And it actually also improves your play. It's been shown to increase club head speed and all sorts of things. So just basic fundamental conditioning, and I'm not talking about joining a gym and hiring a personal trainer named Klaus to stand over you and yell at you. I'm talking about just basic, 20-minute exercise routine, three or four times a week. That's in keeping with a particular player's age and physical capacity.
Okay, Doc. What about you? Do you do this on a regular basis?
You know, it's interesting. I do. The answer is yes.
Oh, okay.
And I've been much better since I wrote the book, and actually I've been much better since last summer. I played more golf last season than I have ever before. And what I noticed is that instead of getting better, that towards the end of the year, you know, come September and October when the golf season is winding down in New York where I live, my play was getting worse.
Why?
I think I was fatigued. I really honestly think I was tired. Just like a baseball pitcher, you know, when they reach the seventh inning, they can still throw the ball over the plate, but the guys are catching up to the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take a whole lot of difference between success and failure. And I think I was getting fatigued, and I really noticed that, especially at the end of a particular round, I was even worse than before. And so to answer your question, I've actually been very good about just doing a 20 to 30 minute lightweight working out routine every other day for the last couple months, and I'll let you know how it goes when I go to Myrtle Beach next month and play six rounds in 5 days and see if it's made a difference. But I think it will.
Oh, you're not going to be able to walk at the end of 5 days.
I hope not. What a way to go, though, right?
Okay. He's got a smile on his face. So I guess that leads us to number two, which is overuse.
That's right, and
that's fatigue.
That is in part fatigue, but also muscles, tendons, ligaments are more prone to injury once they're fatigued. And that's the way most tendonitis injuries occur, for example, just overuse. And actually, the overuse just plays into what I just told you. What did I just say? I'm going to Myrtle Beach next month, and I'm going to play 6 rounds in 5 days. And that's the way golfers tend to be, especially those who live in climates that aren't amenable to playing golf every weekend.
Sure, sure. We're gluttons for punishment.
Yeah, we are. And we always think we can do better. Someone's always asking us to play. If you play in the Northeast or any place where it's cold, the first warm weekend of March or April, they're out there like cockroaches out there on the golf course playing again and again and again. And when we practice, we tend to go to the golf range and buy the super jumbo bucket of balls and just hit ball after ball after ball after bucket, trying to perfect our swing. And so golfers are nuts. They're kind of like long-distance runners and weightlifters in the sense that they thrive on their sport, and they don't want to hear that they have to back off, and they tend not to listen to their bodies when their bodies are telling them that they've got injuries. And so golfers, being of the mindset that they are, tend to overdo it, and that's particularly true of professional golfers because they have to overdo it. They practice and play for a living, so they have to be out there.
All right, let's go to number three.
Number three is inadequate or improper warm-up. And there's a study that I mentioned in Dr. Divitt's Guide to Golf Injuries that was published in the British Medical Journal, British Journal of Sports Medicine, where in Australia, these researchers kind of hid in the bushes. It was kind of a fun study. And they observed 1,000 golfers, recreational golfers, at both a private golf club, a public golf club, and a driving range. And what they did was they took notes on the type of warm-up activities that those 1,000 recreational golfers, men and women combined, did before they hit the first ball off the first tee off the first tee at the driving range. And their conclusion was that the warm-up activities of recreational golfers was woefully inadequate. You have to realize that when you swing a golf club, you're accelerating the club head from 0 to 100 miles an hour plus within about 0.2 seconds. And that to accelerate the club like that, you are stressing parts of your body and certain muscle groups to within about 90% of what they're capable of doing. And so any kind of sports activity like that requires proper preparation, not only basic conditioning, like we said before, but also proper warm-up on the day that you're going to do it.
And I want to just reiterate here that we're not saying that that conditioning and warm-up are the same thing.
No, they're not. They're certainly not, because you can have that's why baseball stadiums have bullpens. Okay, those guys on the baseball team are in tip-top condition, yet they still go out to the bullpen and light toss and stretch and then toss harder and harder and harder until they're called into the game. You would never have a coach sitting next to somebody on the bench and have him turn to the guy and say, okay, Kowalski, go out and strike this guy out, and have him go out there and without warming up or stretching, try to throw a fastball 95 miles an hour. The guy would look at you like you're crazy.
And yet I see people step into the driving range, and the first thing they do is grab the driver.
That's right.
And they try to hit the ball 280 yards.
That's exactly right. And that really is, you know, especially for a recreational golfer who's not in proper condition, that's a big risk. And I think that's, if there's any take-home message that people get from reading my book or from listening to me speak, it's the importance of stretching and warming up before you play. Because that's something that every golfer can do, and it doesn't take a long time. There are basically 4 ingredients to a proper warm-up.
Excellent.
The first of which is time. You have to give yourself the time to do it. So that means building into your schedule 20 minutes, 25 minutes at the most, leaving the office 20 minutes earlier, leaving the home 20 minutes earlier, getting to the golf course without having to rush, without having to throw your shoes on and pay real quickly and get in your cart and go because you're late. You have to build that into your schedule.
Let me ask you a question then. You're not just talking about spending 20 minutes of hitting a bucket of balls.
Absolutely not.
Are you talking about 20 minutes of stretching and then hit your bucket of balls?
No, I think the whole thing should take about 20 minutes. So,
okay.
So the first thing is 20 minutes of time built into your schedule to get to the venue, either the driving range or the golf course, 20 minutes earlier than you would have. And the second is aerobic exercise. Aerobic exercise is the kind of exercise that increases your heart rate and makes you sweat. And 5 minutes of that, and it can be anything from briskly walking around the parking lot several times to doing jumping jacks or running in place or any kind of activity that will increase your heart rate. And again, this all has to be within the capacity and age and physical capacities of the particular golfer.
And we're talking about for golfers to do aerobic exercise.
Absolutely. And people
really?
Will look at you like you got two heads, but guarantee you.
I've never seen anybody at the driving range or at the first tee doing jumping jacks.
Well, maybe they will someday. But you can do it in the parking lot and not be seen, okay? But once you are starting to break a light sweat, that's an indication from your body that your muscles are starting to get warm. Your muscles get warm by two different mechanisms. One is the actual contraction of the muscles actually has sort of a – muscles are sort of little furnaces, and they generate their own heat. And the second way is that the heart pumps blood, which is warm, to the muscles that are being used, and that warms up the muscles. So once the muscles and ligaments and tendons are warm, now you're ready for the next step in the warm-up, and that's stretching. Okay, many people will stretch – cold muscles. I think you get more out of stretching warmed up muscles and tendons and ligaments. And in my book, for example, I have a head to toe stretching routine. So you start with the neck and the shoulders and the elbows and forearms and wrists, and then the lower back, which is real important, and then your hamstrings and quadriceps muscles, the front and back of your thighs, and your calves, and basically a head to toe left right side stretch routine, which again just takes a couple minutes. And then,
is this information also on your website?
It is. A basic overview is on my website, but there's a whole chapter dedicated to warming up and stretching in the book. Now you've given yourself 20. You've got your time. You've done your 5 minutes of aerobic sweat breaking activity. You've done your head to toe stretch.
And is that about now, 5 minutes as well?
And yeah, each is about 5 minutes. And now, and only now, do you grab your club? Okay. But you don't grab the driver, which is admittedly the most fun and the sexiest club to use because it gives you the most bang for your buck. But it's also the longest club, the most strenuous to swing, and the most strenuous on your body. What you should do instead is to grab one of your high-lofted clubs, like your wedge or your 9-iron, and take half swings and then three-quarter swings and then full swings, and swing with that club for just a couple minutes and hit a few balls lightly and then harder, and then alternate clubs down the line. So you go from your 9 to your 7 and do the same thing with your 7, and then from your 7 to your 5, and from your 5 to your 3. And then you go to the woods, you go to the 7 wood, then the 5 wood, and then finally your driver. And what that does then is allow your body to progressively acclimate to the stresses that you're placing on it, because by the time you get that driver and you're first on the tee to go and your buddies are standing around watching you, the adrenaline and the nervousness is going and you're going to be firing full tilt, and you want your body to be ready for that. It's the same analogy as going onto that mound and trying to throw snap off a fastball. You're not going to do that unless you've stretched and warmed up properly. So why do we try to hit a golf ball like Tiger Woods when we're not properly prepared?
So are you saying that the progression of clubs that you should be swinging from your wedges up through your woods, you're swinging those, but you still haven't hit the ball?
No, you can take a few, you know, half swings, then quarter, three-quarter swings, and then start hitting the ball. Because what happens is as the clubs, as you go from higher numbers to lower numbers, the clubs get longer,
right.
They get heavier, and the angle of impact, the angle of inclination of the club becomes more and more vertical. And what that does is that means that your body absorbs more and more force of the impact with the ball, called the counterforce. So again, as you go through that progression, like I suggested, you're gradually increasing the weight and the impact that your body is absorbing from each swing, from the 9-iron down to the driver.
What is your opinion of the weights that you can put on the club, like as we talked about baseball many times already, how they put a donut at the end of the bat.
Yeah, I've done that. I've sometimes grabbed two clubs at a time or three clubs at a time and swing them around. Tom Neoporti, who is the head pro at Wingfoot Golf Club in Mamaroneck, New York, not far from where I live, where they had just had the U.S. Open in the spring, helped me write one of the chapters on the warm-up chapter. And in his clubhouse, he has a in his pro shop, he has about a six-foot metal bar that he keeps propped up against the wall. And he was showing me his warm-up routine, and part of that is to take this bar out and lock his elbows behind behind his back around this bar and to swing back and forth. And that's one of the ways that he's chosen over the years to warm up. And I think the weighted clubs and the weighted devices can help.
What is your opinion? And let's start talking about, I'm really curious about popping pain meds during your round of golf. Naproxen, Aleve, these different things that are supposedly supposed to help you with your muscle pain.
Well, I think they will help you with your muscle pain. I have been known to take a couple Advil or Aleve, especially, in my second or third day in Myrtle Beach. Those medications, it's important to know, won't make you heal faster. Anti-inflammatory medications have never been shown to make any injury go away faster.
What does it do?
But what they do, they provide an anti-inflammatory effect, and what they really are best at is just as analgesics. They're pain medications, and they're non-narcotic, and for the most part cheap and safe. So I think if it helps somebody get through the day and takes the edge off their back or muscle discomfort so that they can still enjoy their round of golf, but not to the exclusion of them doing anything that they otherwise wouldn't be able to do, just by virtue of them taking the drugs, I think in that setting, using the drugs sparingly is okay. I've done it myself.
And is there any proof that magnets help? I mean, they have magnets for your back. They have guys who wear these wristbands. They have things now around the neck. They've got this new glove, the bionic glove, that is supposedly has magnets all throughout it.
I have seen those products pitched very heavily to golfers. I won't name any specific products, but I've been down to the PGA trade show, and I've seen very elaborate...
Oh, go ahead and mention it. Come on. It's just a podcast. I already did.
But I've never really seen a convincing scientific study that has been what's called peer-reviewed, meaning that it's really been scrutinized heavily by the medical literature, by other doctors not involved in the production of the product, that actually prove that they work. Now, having said that, I've actually had patients of mine mention that they think that I actually had a doctor friend of mine once with very bad back pain who tried just about everything under the sun, actually felt better once he stuck the magnets on, and he said nobody was more surprised than I was, but these things seemed to help. So the magnets in particular, from my, when a patient of mine in my practice asks me, do you mind if I use them, or is there a reason to use them? I say, well, you know what, I'm not really convinced that there's any science behind it, but I don't see them as being a dangerous thing or a bad thing. I've never heard of any study that says they're harmful. So I wouldn't discourage somebody from using them if they found it made them putt straighter, more power to them.
Exactly. What would you advise during the round of golf? Now that we've had a great warm-up, we've stretched our body, our muscles are toned up, and they're heated up, and the blood's flowing. Now we've played, 8, 9 holes, 10 holes, we've made the turn, we've had a sandwich. Things are starting to tighten up a little bit, especially in the back.
Right.
What would you advise that we do then?
Continue to stretch and warm up as you play. The tendency is that once the game starts that, many of us ride a cart, which allows you to stiffen up a bit. And so I think doing just a couple of those light stretching exercises and taking some air swings, probably while your buddies are preparing to, not as they're swinging, but as they're getting ready to take their turn, I think that'll do a lot to keep your body stretched out and warmed up, and ready for each swing. Again, that's why when a baseball pitcher comes out and starts a new inning, what do?
They get to warm
about
up.
Eight or nine warm-up tosses.
Only eight. No, not eight.
Yeah, and that's because they've been sitting on the bench for 15 minutes watching. And
especially in the American League, right?
Yeah, right. And their muscles, things tighten up.
Interesting. Okay. And I would think that for younger players, it's very different than senior players, as not only the amount of time you need to warm up, but what you do during your round.
Well, I think, you know, the one of the beauties of golf is that it is something that you can play into your 80s and 90s or beyond if you're lucky enough to live that long. And you know, you don't see too many rugby leagues for golden year people, but golf is
that'd be pretty funny, actually.
It's great like that.
I'd pay to see that.
But older golfers need to understand things about their body. There are a whole host of changes that occur to your body that I'm starting to experience now that I'm in my 40s, and I only expect it's going to get worse. And your muscle bulk decreases, your muscle flexibility and strength dramatically decrease. The flexibility of your lower back decreases about 50% after age 50. So you're more prone to injury, and you are, I think you're slower to heal. So I think golfers, as they get older, have to realize that they have to change their game, be more tuned in to the importance of basic conditioning, flexibility, strengthening, warming up, proper swing technique, things like that. And be aware that they may not be able to swing at the ball the way they at age 50 the way they did when they were 30. Beat a dead horse with the baseball analogy, but you'll find a lot of successful pitchers who pitch into their 40s throw and approach the game a whole lot differently than they did when they were 25.
That's when they're called smarter.
They are smarter, and plus they can't physically throw a ball 98 miles an hour anymore. So
no,
they throw it 88, and they throw it the right way.
Yeah, but the Rocket is still getting millions of dollars to keep
coming
back.
He and Nolan Ryan were exceptions.
The
power pitchers that were successful well into their 40s, but most of them don't. Most of them change. And I think golfers, as they get older, have to realize that they're not I think most older golfers realize that at that point it's a lot more important to hit the ball straight than it is to hit it far anyway.
Yeah. Yep.
Women seem to be a lot smarter about that than guys in
yes,
regard to.
Yes. And by the way, there is a Golden Sunset Touch Football League just near here, and it's actually a lot of fun to watch these people smash.
I'd like to have the ibuprofen
concession for
concession
that one.
For
yeah,
that
they
got right?
They don't sell beer. They don't sell, you know, popcorn. They sell meds. It's actually, they're pushing them. Let me ask you about carrying your golf bag versus pushing a cart. I know that for me, of course, I'd rather walk, but, you know, I get fatigue, especially in Northern California. A lot of our courses are very hilly, so the walk is really a great workout. But when I'm pulling my cart, I'd rather pull than compress my back by carrying the bag. And pulling a cart, my shoulder starts to hurt when I'm pulling. Maybe I should be getting one of those three-wheelie pusher carts. Is there anything there between the carrying versus pulling a cart?
Personally, I enjoy exercise when I golf, but that's for me, that's not the reason I play golf. I play golf to get outside, to be with my buddies or my brother, to drink some beer, have some fun, swear a little bit, and all those things. So for me, I tend to ride in a cart more often than I probably should. However, many people use golf as...
Doc,
as
a, you're only in your 40s. What do you mean you're driving around in your cart?
But many people will walk the course for exercise, and they feel they play better. And I've read many, many authors who say that you can only play your best if you walk the course. carrying a bag, that would be a big... burden. I've seen these specially designed straps and this and that that are supposed to be more back-friendly and shoulder-friendly by distributing the weight over both shoulders, etc. If you're able to carry the bag and be comfortable doing it and still have fun, more power to you. I know that some people, some doctors who do total joint replacements, for example, for golfers, recommend that you not carry your bag because
oh, really?
It's too stressful.
Yeah.
As opposed to pulling or pushing with a hand cart, I think that that's a great compromise, and you're still getting the aerobic exercise of walking the course, which, if you do, actually amounts to about 1,000-calorie burn during an 18-hole round of golf. So it's a pretty good workout.
And you're saying that's walking?
That's walking the course.
Right,
correct.
Okay.
You know, golf has been shown to be a low to moderate aerobic activity, and if you walk the course. So it's not going to make you fit enough to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, but I think it's...
You've never played in Northern California.
It's certainly better than laying on the couch and watching it on TV in terms of your heart and lungs and general health. So I would tell people, to whatever extent they're comfortable and have fun carrying or pulling or pushing the bag, so be it. But for me personally, carrying a bag would probably be a bit much.
You really disappoint me, Doc.
Just being honest.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate that. Let's talk about specific injuries.
Okay.
Let's just ask, what is the most common injury that golfers receive? I don't even know what the right word would be here.
We'd have to separate the populations. If we're going to talk about amateur golfers, which I assume most of the people listening to this broadcast are.
I keep saying hackers unite. Let's
hackers unite. Well, the truth is that only 80% of recreational golfers don't break 100 on a regular basis. So there's a lot of hackers out there. So that's 80% of 25 million. So it starts to add up after a while. If you take recreational golfers, amateur golfers, by far, the two most common injuries are elbow injuries and low back problems. If you take those two injuries together, that accounts for about two-thirds of all injuries to recreational golfers.
Okay, and what causes, let's start with the lower back. What causes that in golf, and what can you do to prevent it?
Well, it's an important thing to remember that low back pain is a common thing in the general population. People who are golfers and non-golfers, most people over the course of their lives will have at least one episode of back pain, and most people have many more than that. And there are a lot of conditions that can contribute to low back pain. It's what we call a multifactorial problem, meaning that there are a lot of things that contribute to it, you know, and they include what you do for a living, your basic level of conditioning, even things like job satisfaction and smoking and things like that seem to have some sort of statistical play in terms of people who get back pain. So golf is just one of those factors. Now, if you take just the game of golf and look at it, what happens when you swing a golf club is that you are basically, especially if you adhere to the sort of the modern golf swing, where there's a very limited pelvic turn and a very generous shoulder turn, what you're doing basically is storing a huge amount of energy in your lower back like a giant spring and uncoiling that spring rapidly to accelerate the club head and to whack the ball. So golf puts a huge amount of, the golf swing puts a huge amount of stress on the muscles, tendons, ligaments, bones, and in particularly on the discs in the lower back. And there have been studies, some of which that I comment on in the book, done out in California, where they used a combination of computer analysis and actual muscle testing of golfers, and they measure the stresses that occur on the lower back during a golf swing, and they are huge. A whole bunch of stresses, compression, torsion, shear, all sorts of nasty stresses on the disc, then over time, with repetition and with poor swing technique, what happens is that the back starts to break down and can start to be painful in lots of different ways. And back pain is actually not just common among recreational golfers, but it's the most common injury or problem among male professional golfers, and the second most common among female professional golfers.
And it's all lower back, correct?
Primarily lower back. That's right, because that's really sort of where the maximum amount of twisting occurs.
And then elbow?
Now, elbow is something that's actually almost exclusively the domain of the recreational golfer. And the reason is primarily conditioning and technique. And those are two areas where the professional golfer has a leg up on the amateur golfer. The professional golfers these days are world-class athletes who understand the importance of conditioning and have trainers follow them around, and they're very motivated to stay in shape. Plus, professional golfers have good swing technique. Otherwise, they wouldn't be professional golfers. But amateur golfers, on the other hand, tend to not be in the best shape, as we said, and tend to have certain types of swing flaws that put extra stress on the elbows, particularly the left elbow for a right-handed golfer. So, interestingly, the condition that recreational golfers tend to get most commonly in the elbow is what's typically called tennis elbow, okay, which refers to a tendonitis on the outer part of the elbow. And so, in the case of a right-handed golfer, it would be the lead or left outer elbow would become painful and tender over time. Typically, something that usually develops over the course of, weeks or months. And then the golfer will notice pain in that part of the elbow when they swing and hit the ball, and then when they do non-golf related activities like grab a suitcase or squeeze a tube of toothpaste or pour the coffee pot in the morning. And tennis elbow, also called lateral epicondylitis, but tennis elbow to the layperson, is a difficult thing to get rid of. But it's a real plague among golfers.
Absolutely fascinating. And there's a whole lot more of this information in the book called Dr. Divitt's Guide to Golf Injuries. And you can go to drdivittmd.com. It's D-O-C-T-O-R, Divitt, D-I-V-O-T, M-D. Medical doctor, .com, if you'd like to find out more and order the book. Doc, we really appreciate the time. This has been really fascinating and enlightening.
Oh, great. Well, that's my goal as a fellow golfer, fellow suffering hacking golfer. being an orthopedic surgeon at the same time, the whole goal was to write something that would be understandable and fun and to help my fellow golfers stay healthy out there.
I've had fun.
Great.
I hope you have, too. Thanks so much, Doc.
Okay, Fred, my pleasure. Thanks. Anytime.
It's time to ask Kenny. Do you have a specific question about golf gear or are baffled about what to look for in a category of golf products? Kenny Nicholson is the sales manager at EdwinWattsGolf.com, and he'd like to help. If we use your question on the show, you're going to receive a free Golf Smarter Edwin Watts Golf hat. To submit your question, send an email to fred@golfsmarterpodcast.com with the subject Ask Kenny. Ask Kenny is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf and edwinwattsgolf.com, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Hey, Kenny, we have a question for you.
Okay, shoot.
All right, well, James Perez of Lake Ann, Michigan asks, how often should grips be replaced? Once a season, once every 25 rounds. What? He lives in northern Michigan, and he gets in about 20 to 25 rounds a season and isn't sure when he should replace them.
That's a good question. Really what you have to look at is rounds and not time. Over a course of time, obviously, grips are made out of rubber, and they can start to dry rot and get a little bit slippery. But the guy that typically plays a little bit more, his grips are going to wear more than they're going to dry rot, i.e. you're going to get some wear in the thumb area where you apply a little bit more pressure. So that would be what somebody would be looking for if they play a lot of golf. Somebody that doesn't play a lot of golf, towards the bottom of the grip, down towards the head size, down towards the head side of the golf club, if grips are getting old, they'll tend to split down at that end of the golf club. And typically when they start to do that, you might want to go and have your grips replaced as well, because that's a good indication that they're starting to dry rot a little bit, and typically they're going to get a little bit slippery to you. And that's not going to bode well for somebody out there trying to play golf.
So if you feel your club head moving when you hit the ball, if it twists a little bit or sliding through as you're releasing, it's time to replace them, huh?
It could be a very good indication. I mean, look at your glove, too, but you can feel with your bare hand. If the grip feels a little bit slippery to you, then yes, it's definitely time to to go and get them replaced. Don't try to do something, you know, rub them with a towel to get them a little bit more coarse or what have you. You see guys on tour doing that sometimes, especially Freddie Couples. He doesn't play with a glove, so before every shot he takes a towel and he rubs his grip. But his grips are probably replaced, you know, if not every tournament, every other tournament, I would think. And speaking of grips, touch on something real quick. Is it important to get grips sized as it is golf clubs?
Really?
It is, typically, because if you have a large hand and you're playing with a small grip, a lot of times the grip can, if you hit the ball towards the toe, and we talked, about the club face opening up, if the grip is small in your hand, it's going to give it a lot more flexibility to twist. And then vice versa, somebody with a small hand playing with a larger grip. So grip size is very important.
Now, I want to clarify this. When you say grip size, are you talking about the thickness of the grip?
Exactly. You can,
really?
You know, they have a standard grip, which is called, I think, a 58 butt size. And then, you know, you can go down from there or up from there. So typically, a guy with larger hands will order a grip. He'll say, you know, hey, I need the grips plus 1/32nd, which is 2 extra wraps of tape. So he gets a mid-size grip. But somebody that's using a grip that's too big for them, what I have typically found is that you're going to hook the ball more with a larger grip, and you're going to slice the ball more with a smaller grip. So it's important to get the grip size correct whenever you're getting them re-gripped or whenever you're buying new golf clubs. There's not an extra charge to do that. If you order something from us and say, hey, look, I need to get these golf clubs and I need to get a different grip size put on them, we'll order them from the manufacturer with the correct grip size and get them shipped to you, and that way they're, you know, just like you need them whenever they get there.
The times that I've had my clubs re-gripped, I drop them off, and I say, I need some new grips. They go, okay, and I leave. They never ask me about size.
Well, we don't touch on it too much with the consumer whenever they order golf clubs. Most of the time, the individual will know. A lot of people don't. That's why I want to bring up the topic and say, hey, listen.
Unbelievable.
It's easy to have a sizing chart on a lot of grip manufacturers, company Golf Pride in particular. I think they have a sizing chart where you just measure your fingers and it'll tell you what size grip you need. And it's very important to get the correct grip size.
Well, James, thanks so much for sending in that question, because that was absolutely fascinating. I'm blown away by that. I had no idea.
More of a topic than you would think, just being a grip question.
Yeah, absolutely. So, James, you're going to get that hat, and I tip mine to you to say thank you very much. That was great. And if you're going to be buying grips or you're going to be buying clubs, the season is starting to come up, make sure that you go to edwinwattsgolf.com and order, because as a Golf Smarter listener, you're going to receive 10% off of any order, and you'll receive free shipping. So you're definitely going to save some money and get exactly what you want. The best way to get there, of course, is to go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the Edwin Watts banner. It'll take you to a special page that we have set up at Edwin Watts Golf that'll give you a full explanation of everything you need to know, which is a good thing. Now, lastly, we'd like to reward you as being a listener. We have another giveaway, and this is the final week of our giveaway for the Tour Edge stand bag. And, Kenny, I had a question about the stand bag, and that is the straps. Is it a single
strap?
Or is it
No, it is a dual strap.
It's a dual strap over your back, right? Gives you
correct.
Better...
Like kind of like a backpack, per se.
Yeah. So how does that work? Does that give better support? Is that for your back, or is it for the clubs?
It distributes the weight. It's for your back, not so much the club. You know, typically when you have a single strap, for years and years, that's all we had. All your weight was on one side. So after 18 holes of golf, you get a little bit tired. So what they've done is they've put a secondary strap on there to go over your other shoulder. If you're right-handed, that strap will go over your left shoulder, and it distributes the weight equally, and it's much more comfortable.
Well, it'd be a worthwhile prize to win, and if you'd like to win it, send an email with the subject Stand Bag Tour Edge, and send your email to pickme@golfsmarterpodcast.com. Along with your email address, please include your name and mailing address so that we can send the prize to you when you win it. For more information, check the show notes. And deadline for entry with your name and address is going to be midnight February 5th, and the winner will be announced on February 6th. Okay, that's it for today, Kenny. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Fred. Take care.
Okay, well, now you know what a morning voice sounds like. I don't know if you could tell, but listening to that for me, I obviously recorded that early in the morning when I was just waking up, and boy, does my voice sound like it. Well, let's get it over with already. This week's closing quote comes from Tim Stanley in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And the best golf quote was from his dad. In an effort to get him to relax on the course and stop trying to over-examine his swing during play, his dad told him this: practice on the range like your life depends on every swing. Play on the course like you don't care. Please send your quotes, your comments, your suggestions, and requests to Fred at GolfSmarterPodcast.com.